Today, the 16th day of June, 1973, I, Carolyn Puckett, am interviewing with the author Alan Stovall at his home here in Barksdale, Texas.
I'll begin over again. And the Stovall moved to Harrison County in 1848 from Mississippi. There were three brothers in my father's family and several girls. My father was not a very strong man, and the climate there didn't agree with him, so he came to Edwards County looking for a pastorate, and he found one here in Barksdale. He also preached in Montel and Vance and at Hackberry during that time. He preached from 1907 until 1911. I remember that he used to ride an old gray horse from here to Hackberry, and one time he came from town walking, and he had a saddle on his back. And my mother asked him what in the world he was going to do with that saddle. And he said, "Well, I'm going to buy me a horse." "Am I not?" So he got the cart for the horse there. Anyway, he went 2 years to Baylor University at the time when Dr. George Truett was attending there. He was married on October 16th, 1890, to Adam O. McCook of Upshur County. That was my mother. And he was licensed to preach at Hebron Baptist Church of Harrison County, September 1885, was ordained at Jonesville, Texas, the 20th of October, 1888. And he held pastorates at Cave Springs, Macedonia, Friendship, Mount Zion, Hebron, Sharon, Overton, Providence, Mount Sullivan, London, and Red Level. They didn't keep pastors very long in those days. And all during this time, he taught school and had a farm over there, joining his brothers. He taught school in Macedonia, Cave Springs, Hope, Friendship, Sandy Hill, Maple Springs, and Glade Springs. He taught several terms at each of two of these places. We came by train from Overton to Uvalde, and then when we got to Uvalde, there was a man that lived in Montel, picked the family up there and brought them up here, and we stayed at his place a night or two. I remember that's about the first memory that I have of things. I was just under 4 years old when we moved here. And we lived in two or three places in Barksdale before we moved down here and bought this little place. We've owned this place since 1908. My father had eight children in the family, and he got $800 a year. That's $100 a piece per year. So, did very well, because he had paid part of his place out. In 1911, he decided to move, and he went out to Sanderson, Texas, to look for a pastorate, and while he was there, he took pneumonia and died. And you can imagine what condition our family was left in. My mother had no training for any kind of work, and we had a pretty hard time for two or three years. In 1913, she went to Uvalde and took the examinations for postmaster. There was a vacancy here, and she was appointed as postmaster. She served in that capacity for 13 years, and she managed to give every one of the family an education that wanted one. You see, we have my brother has a master's degree, and I have one sister that did her doctorate work she didn't do her dissertation, and I have another sister that has her master's degree. And then I have my oldest sister, she taught school several years in the canyon here. So that gives a little bit of a background on my family. And then I guess about the longest period of my life was from the time that we moved here until I was 18. I guess it was because I was waiting until I got 18 years old, so. And when I was 18, I got out on my own then, and I graduated from high school in 1920. I went 1 year to Tyler, Texas during the war, when it was the year that the armistice was signed. Came back here and graduated the next year, graduated from the 10th grade. We just had 10 grades here. Then the next year, two of my sisters and I went to Rusk, Texas. My oldest sister had a job teaching over there, and we stayed there 1 year. I believe she made $110 a month. That was in 1920, fall of 20 and the spring of 21. Next year, I didn't do anything. I just fooled around. But the following year, I went back to Rusk and graduated from junior college there in 1923, and that's when I began to teach that fall. Are there any questions now that you'd like to ask? Kimball County, down here, 1878, and they moved up on the head of Cedar Creek. And the first Indian trouble they had was in 1878, Nick Colson and two of his boys, Arthur and Johnny, were out on the head of Cedar Creek herding sheep, and they were attacked by these Indians. Arthur was killed and Johnny was left for dead. And then the following year, the Indians came back and killed Mrs. Colson and a 12-year-old girl and a small child. So altogether, there were four members of the family killed by Indians up there. And they're buried up there on a place called Half Moon Prairie. This marker that we have up here in town is the one that we put up in memory of that period. Then there was a man killed by the Indians up on Pulliam. His name was Coates. He was a sheep herder for Mr. Pulliam. That was back in the late 70s. There's a big mountain up there near where he was killed. It's called Coates Mountain. And it's supposed to be where, you know, Emperor Maximilian went to Mexico and set up his reign there for a while during the Civil War, I believe it was. And he was executed. Mexico killed him, and his widow undertook to get back to Spain. And she had all of her jewels and treasures with her. And they were supposed to have been buried in a cave on Coates Mountain. Of course they weren't. That's just an old legend. Anyway, that was another massacre that took place here. Then over on the Frio, that's above Lakey, there was a McLaren family that was massacred. Mrs. McLaren and a boy, a 12-year-old boy, were killed by the Indians. This boy was named Alan Lease, and Mrs. McLaren's husband, all cypress shingles, lumber, for John Leckie to Uvalde. And he was killed by the Indians on one of those trips. And then down here at Camp Wood in 1867, there was a family living there named Swanner. There was a man and his wife and one son. The Indians, while the father was away, sheep, the Indians attacked the cabin and killed Mrs. his father, and took the boy captive, carried him over into Mexico and sold him. And then,
did they ever hear from the boy again?
Well, yes, his father finally ransomed him. He was sold to a Mexican over there. Schwander had to sell all of his goods, all of his possessions to ransom the boy. But he was brought back. And then that the advance cases were about 1875. There was Williams killed by the Indians. And he's buried up there at Vance.
What year was all this going on, this Indian killing?
Indian killing was in the 1870s. The last Indian massacre was in 1883. That was in the McLaren Hill. In fact, that was the last Indian raid in Texas, according to the record.
I thought the Colsons were the last ones killed. I thought that's why the marker was there.
No, the Colsons were killed before the McLarens. Colson were killed, family was killed in 1879, McLarens in 1883.
What type of Indians were up in here?
They were the Pan Apaches. Let me see if that wasn't 1883, McLarens were killed. August 19th. Last Indian raid occurred August 19th, 1882. Here are the McLarens at a place called Buzzard Ridge on the trail above Lakey. This mission was originally set up, of course, in New Brunswick. Well, it was in Milam County, close to Rockdale. Then it was moved to a place between San Marcos and New Brunswick. There it was moved to San Saba. And then the Indians raided the mission there and killed all the personnel. So then they moved down to the canyon. They set up a mission at Camp Wood in 1872. And 1 month later, they went down and established one at Montel. The one at Camp Wood is called San Lorenzo de la Santa Cruz, and the one at Montel was Nuestra Señora de la Candelaria. And they operated 6-7 years, and finally they just had to abandon it because the Indians got so bad and they couldn't do much about converting the Indians. Recently they did some reconstruction work on the Camp Wood mission, and they unearthed the foundations and found out how many buildings there were on the mission grounds. They found several skeletons. They had a smallpox epidemic at Camp Wood while the missionaries were there, and two or three Indian raids. You know, it was remarkable that those priests could come out and hold out as long as they did from those savage Indians like that. I'm sure Baptist preachers wouldn't hold out a week.
Well, what was this epidemic?
The smallpox.
Mm-hmm. What other epidemics around here, you know, happened that really killed a lot of people?
Dysentery, typhoid killed lots of people, early settlers.
There were a lot of epidemics?
Yeah, the epidemics, those, they didn't have any sanitary conditions. Malaria was bad. They never did have any evidence of smallpox among the whites that I know of here. But people died from lead poisoning quite often too.
From lead poisoning?
Mm-hmm. Shot. Mm-hmm. They got shot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I thought you meant no. Okay.
That next to the coast marker is old cotton gin. A cotton gin, a grist mill, and a sawmill. When we moved to this country, had a bank, had a house where they sold coffins. They didn't make sell many coffins, they made them. I remember one time that a man died over here in this house, and they buried him for $16.
Pretty cheap. Well, like agriculture, I know your mutton is a big agriculture thing up here. But what else is, the livelihood mostly?
The cedar business has been real good since the 1920s when they built the railroad to Camp Wood. They had a big cedar break back west of Camp Wood and also one east of here. They worked those for 1920 into the war. And they sold hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of cedar. Provided employment for a lot of people. Now there's not much farming. There used to be a lot of irrigated farming along the rivers. They don't do any more of that now. And ranching mainly. Goats, sheep, cattle.
Has it just about stayed the same, the way it was with the agricultural thing? Has it stayed, or has it changed? Are people using different things now? Or?
Well, people don't stay on the ranches now like they used to. They have cars, and they stay in town a lot of the time.
Well, maybe you'd like to tell us just a little bit about your two books, when you wrote them, and basically what's in each one of them, you know, what the purpose was.
I had the idea of writing these books, and it originated when some people here in Barksdale began to collect history for the 100th anniversary of the creation of the county. It was 1958. The county was created in 1858. So this material looked so interesting that I thought I'd just go ahead and collect it out and make a book out of it. So I did, and I interviewed about 100 people for this book. Just the old timers. Most of them are dead now.
And that's the New Orleans County headwaters.
Then I gathered these pictures. That took a lot of work. I gathered pictures from everybody in the country. I have about 42 pages of pictures, about 700 different photographs, and about 3,000 people have their pictures in this book. And I had this book published in 1959, I believe. 1959. Naylor Publishing Company. Naylor Company. San Antonio published it. Cost about $8,000.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I had 2,000 copies made, and Ms. Naylor took 500. And she, I made a mistake by letting her take 500 because she just gave me the small royalty, and she used up a lot of my market, you see. Most of the libraries she supplied with this book. I have this little book in Columbia University, and Duke University, and Chicago University, and University of Michigan, Ohio, Los Angeles, all of Texas, A&M, University of Texas, University of Houston,
and
Dallas.
The name of this book is?
Lakes of the Balcones. Do you want to know the origin of that name? We live on the edge of the plateau. Edwards Plateau is 22 million acres in area, and it was lifted up sometime in the past, millions of years ago, maybe 100 million years ago, when this plateau was raised up, about 1,000 feet above the plain. And then as time passed, the water running off the plateau carved these river valleys. and that's how they can be. And they're also called breaks, where the plateau breaks into the canyons. It's spelled G-R-A-B-R-E-A-K-S. Yeah. Anyway, and Balcones means shelf. It's a shelf, you see. Evidently, whenever this plateau was raised up, it was just a bluff, shelf, balcony. And people that came to this country first settled in the breaks along the headwater stream, headwaters of the streams where they get water. And that's the reason they call it the breaks of balconies.
And which one of these books did you write first? That one first?
This one was 1959, and that one 1967.
And your first book was mostly just accounts of different...
Interviews countries. With people, old-timers.
Uh-huh. And then this second book...
My wife and one of my daughters and I went to Uvalde and went through all of the Uvalde Leader News from the time that they started printing them until about 1944.
And in the second book, what did you use for
We went to the University of Texas and researched there. I went through all 36 volumes of Frontier Times magazine.
Uh-huh.
And then I had access to several libraries in Texas, and one man in Uvalde let me borrow his books.
So then
I interviewed some people for that book,
you did?
Too. Mm-hmm.
But the first book was mostly
interviews. Then I went to the county seats of Edwards County and Rialto County and got the court records. Commissioner's court records. A lot of information.
What do you think brought the people to this area mostly?
Oh, GTT, gone to Texas. Some of them.
Uh-huh.
He got in trouble back in Tennessee and Alabama and Mississippi, and they came to Texas on the Dodge. So there's a lot of them were on the Dodge, but most of them came just because of new country and they wanted the opportunity to settle in new country. A lot of them came after the Civil War. However, this canyon here was settled in the late 70s, again in the late 70s. Some of them came as early as 1875. So they came for various reasons, and most of them were real poor. Some of them had livestock, brought the livestock with them. This book tells about the trips, quite a few of them. Let me read you an account of one. An index is a real handy thing to have in the book. Here's one family that came in 1883. Dow Perkins' family moved his family to the canyon and settled at the mouth of Open Hollow above Vance. John Perkins' family stopped at Barksdale, located in a little tickety house in the southwest part of town. Dick Perkins recalls that he was just a small boy when his family arrived in Barksdale. As the wagon was coming up the hill into town, he remembers that he stuck his head from under the wagon sheet just in time to see a man riding down the hill on a horse, shooting a pistol with one hand and ringing the cowbell with the other. Dick says he saw no more of Barksdale on that trip. Joe Roberts, oldest daughter, now Mrs. Sally Revis, recalls some of the things that happened on their trip from Bastrop County to the canyon. She was 11 years old when her people reached Edwards County. She says that their party was 1 month on the road. They came with the Dr. Pannell family and were driving a considerable herd of cattle. They had lots of little calves on the road. Dr. Pannell had a big hack, and Hal Pannell placed ropes in the hack and hauled the young calves too big to follow their mothers. They stopped at the old Dietrich Ranch on the Divide and stayed about a week to rest and recuperate their stock. They moved down Bullhead and stayed one night at the Kelly O'Leary Ranch near the head of the creek. Their dog had puppies there that night, and the wheel of one of their wagons broke. The next morning, they propped the wheel up with some cedar poles and went into Barksdale, where they had the wheel fixed at the Ackerley Blacksmith Shop. So that's just one experience. Description I wrote about a place up on Cedar Creek. One of the beauty spots of the Nueces Canyon and a place of interest for many people over a wide area is the Painted Bluff on the old Dan Roberts Ranch on Cedar Creek. That's her father. And it's where the Indians did some picture writing up there. The high bluff on which the picture writing is located is some 2 miles above the Dan Roberts house. The trail that connects the two places passes close by a large hole of deep blue water.
Yes.
Just above the water hole is a series of strong springs from which gush sparkling streams of clear, cold water. The supply of water from these springs is unfailing. Masses of ferns and other water plants line the riverbank for some distance, and just above the springs, the trail runs under an overhanging bluff from which steep springs send forth constant drip of water. Farther on up the river bed, one can see in the distance the towering precipice known as Painted Bluff. The face of the cliff is a beautiful sight to behold. Rising almost perpendicularly from the river's bed, the bluff rears its majestic head more than 300 feet into the sky. In the stratified face of the cliff is written the story of the ages. Eons of time have passed since the first ripple of water carried its tiny load of eroded material across the spot, and in this ages thereafter contributed to the slow carving of the deep canyon that is now Painted Bluff Canyon. Underneath and near the upper end of the bluff may be seen the colorful picture writing of the Indian tribes of days gone by. Some archaeologists believe that the spot was a sort of post office through which the Indians communicated with one another. No one has yet been able to decipher the hieroglyphic lettering that the Indians used, but without a doubt the pictures on the cliff do have a meaning, and for one to discover a code by which the meaning can be brought to light might reveal some interesting facts concerning the life of the Indians who roamed the canyon country before the coming of the white man. They hanged most of the time in the early days. No, I don't know of anybody that was ever hanged. There was one Mexican burned at the county seat in 1910. He killed a white woman, and a mob took him out of the hands of the sheriff and took him out to the edge of town and burned him at stake. Because he killed this white woman. Didn't give the benefit of the trial.
But did that happen very often, or?
No, that's the only time it ever did happen. I think people are still so ashamed of it, they don't ever talk about it.
So mostly a trial or something?
Yeah. I had a jury trial Monday, not Tuesday, driving while intoxicated, and they turned him loose.
That's pretty rare.
All right, the jurors turn loose there, because they believe him. Right. There. Franklin D. Roosevelt was a Democratic candidate in 1932 for the office of President of the United States and was elected by an overwhelming majority of voters. Mr. Roosevelt and his platform had promised to help the farmer and the laboring man. In the ensuing years that he held office, more progress was made in the way of social, economic, political reform that had ever been made in a life period of time in the country's history. Immediately after assuming the office of president in January of 1933, he called Congress into special session and presented to that body his program of reform. Most of the suggestions made were passed on by the Congress and became law in 1933. Emergency measures were passed to bring immediate relief to the country. All the banks of the country were closed for a period of time in order that an assessment of their financial condition could be made. Many of the banks were declared insolvent and were never reopened. Commodities such as food and clothing were distributed through local agencies by the federal government, and many people who had previously been self-sufficient found themselves recipients of charity. federal agencies such as the WPA and PWA distributed money to counties for the relief of the unemployed. Most of the money that came to Edwards and Riall counties at first was used for the building and improvement of roads. The young people of the country were helped directly and their parents indirectly by the NYA and the CCC agencies. The NYA helped students in the high schools and colleges, and the CCC placed boys and young men in camps over the country.
This was in the Depression years, right?
That's during the Depression years. The price of goats had fallen to the low figure of 25 cents a head. People bought big fat muttons for 50 cents per head and canned them with their home canning outfits. Most farm families possessed a pressure cooker and a can sealer. Sometimes cans were used as many as three times before being discarded. The writer remembers that in 1933, his family and the Whatley family, that's my sister, canned 1,200 cans of farm produce of all kinds. Now here's where things begin to kind of pick up, though. The economic conditions were bad in 1935, but somewhat improved over those of the period immediately following the stock market crash of 1929. Hemp priming by the federal government had put billions of dollars in circulation, but unemployment was still at a record peak. Various remedies were offered by armchair political strategists for relief, but no quick return to prosperity plans were presented that proved to be practical. Among the many schemes proposed was the one offered by Dr. Townsend of California. The plan was a kind of utopian dream that would function to restore prosperity to the land by granting all people over 65 years of age a pension of $200 a month. The plan worked well on paper. The program was to be financed by a national sales tax, and the revenue thus derived was calculated to set up a sort of a perpetual motion economic cycle in which the revenue would always exactly balance the expenditure, and in the process everybody would receive sufficient income to support him on the proper living standard. In its first premise, the plan claimed by giving pensions to all people of 65 years of age, that group would be removed from the class of employed people, and the jobs thus vacated would be open to younger people without employment. The second premise declared that a $200 monthly income would be sufficient not only to support an elderly person, but to take care of quite a number of his immediate family as well. The latter group would not then need jobs, but thus creating more positions for people who wanted to work. Of course, the old law of supply and demand would have to be repealed to make this new theory operate, but that was all right too, because the old law never did work anyway, or so they said.
This was the end of the interview with the author, Alan Stovall. For any future information, please consult either of his books, Nueces, Headwater County, or Breaks on the Balconies.